Hello and welcome to the AusMed Handover podcast. My name is Darren Wake, and today we're going to be looking at one of the most incredible and yet virtually unknown projects involving the nursing profession and how it has shaped the health of women today. To understand the context of what I'm going to be talking about, we need to pop back to the East Coast of America in the early 1970s. Back then, a researcher at the Harvard Medical School, Dr. Frank Spicer, came up with the bright idea that female nurses might be a good cohort of subjects to observe over a very long period of time, maybe a whole lifetime, to learn about the potential risk factors for cancer and cardiovascular disease in women. Why nurses? Well, Frank had two good reasons. Firstly, nurses were and still are renowned for their commitment not just to local healthcare, but also to improving global health outcomes. So not much was required to successfully pitch the idea to them. And secondly, because their training would mean they already had an especially refined capacity to respond to research questions with a high degree of accuracy. Of course, there's an element of self-interest involved too. Participating nurses will be able to find out what the risks to their health were over a long period of time and how their own health compared to others when the findings were released. This combination of factors and the size of the available and willing population is, of course, pure gravy for any researcher, because it's especially rare. It means that researchers could access very high quality data without having to employ thousands of data collection personnel, who ironically would have been nurses anyway. A lifetime commitment from participants meant that researchers could also undertake the rarest of projects, a very long-term longitudinal study of women's health over decades, rather than obtaining a high quality health snapshot of a single and short moment in time. There's literally only a tiny, tiny handful of studies around today that can claim to be similar, one of which is an offshoot of the Nurses' Health Study anyway. So, a researcher's dream. A very large volume of high-quality data that could be obtained easily and very, very cheaply. And that makes it a dream proposition for any funding body too. So, in 1976, Spicer obtained funding from the US National Institute of Health, and the Nurses' Health Study No. 1 was launched. Given it was the old analogue days, printed letters were sent out to 170,000 female married nurses aged between 30 and 55 in the most populous states of America: California, Connecticut, Florida, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. Married nurses were chosen because, just like today, single nurses were much more inclined to take advantage of the global demand for qualified nurses and spend a few years travelling. Consequently, they would be much harder to track. Whereas married nurses were much more prone to stay put in one spot with their families, at least in theory. Plus, given it was a lifetime study, their spouses would have been good, easy to locate follow-up contacts if, for some reason, any nurse being tracked was unable to answer survey questions, either through disability or death, which were also two of the factors being researched. A stunning 122,000 nurses consented to participate, which is an astonishing and unprecedented outcome for a research project participant call. And so in 1976, the study began tracking their health and lifestyle for as long as they either agreed or remained alive. Now, as I mentioned briefly, nurses essentially consented to researchers tracking not just their lives and health, but the manner of their death as well. And around 10% of the original participants died over the following years of the study. However, you'll be pleased to know that over 90% of the original respondents still participate today, providing invaluable data on the health of not just nurses, but women as a whole throughout their entire lifespan. This continued participation is one of the most important components of the study. Several much smaller observational snapshots of women's health profiles have been compared to the findings of the Nurses' Health Study, and it appears that even though all the participants are engaged in the same career, the state of their health and the lifestyle choices they make are not really that different from women as a whole in the US, Australia, and Europe. The big bonus is that the Nurses' Health Study has accrued an incredibly huge amount of data over time. It's still ongoing, and the data collection is consistently very accurate. Thanks to the skills and dedication of the participating nurses, this means that researchers all over the world don't have to pitch any kind of new observational study to a cohort of women in their region and hope to secure participants. They already have access to a good quality database that contains almost all of the data they will ever need, and it's representative of the population as a whole. Although this was lining up to be the biggest epidemiological database the world has ever seen, in 1989, Dr. Walter Willett successfully obtained additional funding to increase the cohort of subjects to begin what is now known as the Nurses' Health Study No. 2. This study literally encompassed the next generation of nurses and targeted women between the ages of 25 and 42. And without exaggerating at all, it became immediately apparent that a very large percentage of the new cohort were actually the children of the participants of the first Nurses' Health Study. So an interested and unexpected early finding of the second study was that nursing, in the USA at least, is mainly a family profession, with mothers inspiring daughters to enter the career, at least for one generation anyway. So this new observational study specifically aimed to record data related to the diet and lifestyle risk factors of participants, and immediately recruited an additional 117,000 nurses to the collective Nurses' Health Study database, again of which 90% are still alive and still continue to contribute valuable data. But wait, there's more, and an amazing more at that. Not only do nurses contribute to the world's biggest epidemiological database on women's health that has ever existed, it also seems their offspring provide the data upon which the majority of worldwide childhood lifestyle and dietary recommendations made by government health authorities. Participants of the Nurses' Health Study 2 were invited to enroll their children in the US Growing Up Today study, which looks at how diet and exercise influences a child's health as they grow and mature. Rather amazingly, nurses enrolled nearly 28,000 of their own children in this study, which represents virtually all of the participants' children at the time the call went out. We'll be talking about the GUTS study in another episode of this podcast, and as by itself it makes for some pretty amazing discussion. Now, although the Nurses' Health Study now had a database of nearly 250,000 participating nurses, in 2010, Drs. Willett, Rich Edwards, Misma and Shavaro secured even more funding, what is now seen to be the most important of the studies, and is likely to increase the database to nearly 500,000 nurses, or about 17% of all the registered nurses in North America. Their phase, the Nurses' Health Study No. 3, aims to look at the issues related to lifestyle, fertility, pregnancy, environment and nursing exposures, and the study began recruiting in 2010. The last two categories of inquiry are extremely interesting if you're a nurse, as they will be looking over a long period of time at what workplace environmental and logistical factors affect the long-term health of nurses. It's already clear from the NHS 1 and 2 that some aspects of the job are directly responsible for the early deaths of nurses. We looked at how night duty is a virtual death sentence in episode 2 of this podcast, so it's an important study, and the findings are very likely to change the way we work as nurses. Certainly, I think the findings will put the heebie-jeebies up all of our employers. So, if you live in the USA or Canada, you can participate in this research. The Nurses' Health Study No. 3 is openly recruiting right now, and you can become part of one of the most amazing, ambitious, important, and influential epidemiological studies ever attempted on this planet. I'll give you details at the end of this podcast. All up, the NHS 1, 2 and 3 collectively represent the biggest worldwide epidemiological database on women's health, and the membership is very, very exclusive. It's only open to female nurses, and the Growing Up Today study is composed solely of their children. So the question pops into one's mind as to what data these studies collect and how it is collected. Initially, for the NHS 1, participants completed a survey upon enrolment in the program and thereafter received questionnaires about their health and lifestyle twice a year. These questionnaires continue to be expanded and modified accordingly, depending on the developments, needs and advances of the various medical specialties. For instance, since 1980, the questionnaire has included a dietary section, and participants of NHS 1 are often required to provide blood, toenail, and urine samples for analysis. If a participant dies, the next of kin are contacted and respectfully asked if they will volunteer details about the death and, if feasible, the autopsy records. The NHS 2 and NHS 3 programs don't require any pathology samples, and since the rise in popularity of the internet, the surveys are conducted online. All of the information is collected and entered into the main database at Harvard Medical School, and the NHS 1, 2 and 3 in combination provides the data that virtually every major researcher in the world mines when researching issues related to women's health. Now, this is astonishing. If there's a published medical study out there that has changed the way we view and treat women's health, some, if not all of the data probably came from the Nurses' Health Study database. There is no other epidemiological database on this planet that is as accessible, as comprehensive, accurate, and downright large. It's not just a record of what lifestyle choices nurses make and what diseases they get, but how they die, where they die, and what it was that ended their life. It's an amazing record of how nurses live and how they die, and nothing else like it exists on the planet. At some point in the far future, historians will have an amazing record of the lives and deaths of over 500,000 nurses, a wealth of data that is historically unprecedented and unlikely ever to be replicated. I can seriously imagine that at some time, perhaps a couple of centuries from now, the archetypal 20th century woman portrayed in the media and movies and in historical texts will be based on the data gleaned from those women participating in the Nurses' Health Study. And it exists solely because more than 250,000 nurses care enough about their fellow women to unfailingly provide data about their own health and lifestyle on a regular basis for decades at a time. And virtually nobody knows about this, not even nurses. This is an unprecedented and stunning example of genuine altruistic behaviour, and it's not seen in any other profession. The number of research papers published using data from the Nurses' Health Studies that have changed the way we view and treat women's health are already in the thousands, and a very large number of these have been groundbreaking or seminal papers in their respective fields. I suspect that there are many findings that you'll recognise, and yep, if you recognise them, I bet you didn't realise they came out of data obtained from the Nurses' Health Studies. They sound almost commonplace to recount, but remember that until they emerged from the study, no one was talking about them. It's the Nurses' Health Studies that started the buzz. I'll break some of these findings into categories for you, and I should point out that this is just a tiny sample of the findings that are emerging. Coronary artery disease. The onset and severity of coronary heart disease in women was found to be strongly influenced by dietary and lifestyle factors. As obvious as it sounds, the NHS was the study that slam-dunked this fact home. Lifestyle. Regular exercise, including exercise as simple as 30 minutes of brisk walking, protects against heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and colon cancer in women. Obese women are 3 times more likely to develop heart disease, twice as likely to have a stroke, and 50% more likely to develop colon cancer than lean women. Obesity also increases the risk of type 2 diabetes, endometrial cancer, gallstones, kidney stones, and asthma. Losing even a modest amount of weight will improve outcomes across the whole health spectrum. Smoking. As a woman, the chance of you dying early of a tobacco-related disease if you're a lifetime smoker is 2.3 times higher than if you don't smoke at all. And if you do quit smoking, then you still have a 1.5 times higher chance of dying earlier than a lifetime non-smoker. There is no strong relationship between smoking and breast cancer. There is a strong association, however, between smoking and coronary heart disease, stroke, and colon cancer. Also an increased risk of hip fractures and macular degeneration. Encouragingly, the risk of pancreatic cancer was found to fall away dramatically soon after quitting smoking. the use of oral contraceptives. Curiously, the data from the studies strongly suggest that the use of oral contraceptives is associated with an increase in certain mortalities. These include violent or accidental deaths and breast cancer. In respect to violent or accidental deaths, no one is sure why, but the data is pretty solid that there is a relationship. However, women taking oral contraceptives for at least 5 years are half as likely to develop ovarian and endometrial cancers as those who have never taken them. Alcohol. Women who take hormone replacement therapy and consume more than 1.5 drinks a day increase their risk of breast cancer by 30% over women on HRT who don't drink at all. Moderate or regular alcohol intake reduces the risk of heart disease. Yep, the Nurses' Health study is the one that suggested that a glass of red a day is cardioprotective. However, excessive consumption of alcohol is related to an increased risk of hip fractures, but moderate consumption is associated with improved bone density. A half to one unit of alcohol a day reduces the risk of cognitive impairment. Diet. There is no strong evidence that overall dietary patterns and diet quality are linked to irritable bowel syndrome. The consumption of whole grains reduces the incidence of coronary heart disease, especially in non-smokers. The incidence of suicide amongst women decreases with the amount of coffee consumed. 20 years of data on coffee consumption by nurses showed that long-term coffee consumption, regardless of the caffeine content, that is, whether you drink decaf or full strength, was associated with an 8% decrease in the risk of type 2 diabetes. And drinking more than 6 cups a day reduces your risk of coronary heart disease. The consumption of 2 or more servings of artificially sweetened soft drinks per day doubles the risk of kidney function decline. Decreasing fat intake without changing the relative portions of animal and plant-based foods does nothing to decrease the incidence of breast cancer. Consistently high intake of green leafy vegetables and cruciferous vegetables, that's broccoli and cabbages and so forth, result in a significantly slower rate of cognitive decline in old age. Increased consumption of red meat is associated with an increased risk of all-cause mortalities, but substituting poultry, fish, legumes, nuts, grains, or low-fat dairy products for red meat is associated with a lower mortality risk. The regular use of cholesterol-lowering statin drugs has been found to be associated with a moderate reduction in the incidence of Parkinson's disease. Eating nuts reduced the incidence of heart disease. The so-called Mediterranean diet reduces the risk of coronary heart disease and stroke. This has been subject to a fair bit of contemporary debate, but remember, it's the Mediterranean diet as consumed by American women in America, not consumed by residents of the Mediterranean countries. Increased dietary calcium intake by postmenopausal women was not found to be protective against hip fractures. Diabetes. There is a significant relationship between sleeping less than 5 hours a day and the onset of type 2 diabetes. Go figure. A strong relationship exists between obesity and non-insulin dependent type 2 diabetes. Exercise. 17% of all of the deaths of study participants could be directly attributed to a sedentary lifestyle, that is, exercising less than 30 minutes a day. Adherence to a lifestyle that incorporated low saturated and trans fat diet, exercise, and abstinence from smoking was the most effective pathway to reducing the risk of heart disease, with up to 80% of diabetes and heart disease cases being avoidable with these simple interventions. Breast cancer. In women with a prior hysterectomy, the risk of breast cancer is increased significantly after 20 or more years of HRT use. The combined use of estrogen and testosterone HRT is associated with a 17% increased risk of breast cancer per year of use. Night duty. Basically, it's going to wreck your life, but I've committed a whole episode of another podcast to this topic. And that summary of findings is hardly exhaustive at all. That's just a random, interesting selection cherry-picked from the literature. All of these findings I have mentioned have in some major way shaped and changed the practices of healthcare professionals across the world. This includes doctors, nurses, dietitians, physiotherapists, occupational therapists, health journalists, personal trainers, and so on. The list is endless. And isn't this amazing stuff? And all thanks to the good grace of the nurses that have unselfishly given their time, blood, and toenails to the research coordinators. It's one of the big, big secrets of the profession, and is so typical of nurses, and is something that happened and continues to happen discreetly and quietly. I tip my hat to you ladies, you're changing the world. So, if you're a nurse, or even a student nurse, aged between 19 and 46, you live in the USA or Canada, and would like to be a part of the Nurses Health Study 3, you can enrol online by going to www.nhs3.org. Once enrolled, you'll be required to take an online survey every 6 months for the rest of your life and consent to providing the researchers with information about when and how your life ends. My understanding is that the NHS3 does not require you to ever provide pathology samples, although you should check the FAQ just to make sure. So I guess you can keep your toenail clippings at this point in time. I hope you found this episode of the AusMed Handover podcast interesting. I certainly enjoyed researching it, and I hope it makes you proud of the profession as a whole, because the Nurses Health Study really is changing the world for the better. This is the AusMed Handover podcast. My name is Darren Wake, and thank you for listening.